details of a possible deal are being discussed in the Israel-Hamas conflict.
U.S., Qatari, and Egyptian mediators are preparing a diplomatic push to bridge differences between Israel and Hamas on the proposed truce that includes the release of the remaining hostages held in Gaza.
Plus, riots in the streets as elections are postponed in Senegal.
They've been triggered by concerns that Sall, who has reached the constitutional limit of 2 terms in office, would run again. Demonstrations have also taken place over the alleged political sidelining of opposition leader Ousmane Sonko.
And later, will internal politics derail Ukraine's military? And India's Navy aims to make a splash in the Arabian Sea. Today is Wednesday, February 7th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The big news on Wednesday is the proposed deal between Israel and Hamas that would release the hostages in stages while drawing back Israeli forces. Reuters' Diane Toe has the story.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is set to be in Israel on Wednesday to discuss the next steps in a ceasefire plan for Gaza after Hamas gave what it called a positive response to the proposal the evening before.
There's still a lot of work to be done. But we continue to believe that an agreement is possible and indeed essential.
Blinken was speaking in Qatar during a lightning tour of the Middle East. U.S., Qatari, and Egyptian mediators are preparing a diplomatic push to bridge differences between Israel and Hamas on the proposed truce that includes the release of the remaining hostages held in Gaza.
That offers the prospect of extended calm, hostages out, more assistance in. That would clearly be beneficial to everyone, and I think that offers the best path forward. But there's a lot of work to be done to achieve it.
Hamas replied on Tuesday to the framework drawn up more than a week ago by U.S. and Israeli spy chiefs at a meeting with the Egyptians and Qataris. In a statement later, Hamas said it responded in a positive spirit to ensure, quote, a comprehensive and complete ceasefire, ending the aggression against our people, ensuring relief, shelter, and reconstruction, lifting the siege on the Gaza Strip, and achieving a prisoner swap. The mediators did not disclose details of the response, but Qatar said it gave them hope, while Egyptian security sources told Reuters that Hamas showed flexibility.
There's been a response.
In Washington, U.S. President Joe Biden said cautiously that the reply showed some movement toward a deal. Sources close to the talks have said the truce would last at least 40 days. During this time, Gaza's militants would free the remaining civilian hostages taken during the deadly cross-border attack into Israel on October the 7th. In the next phases, they would hand over soldiers and dead bodies of hostages in return for releases of Palestinians imprisoned in Israel. The truce would also increase the flow of food and other aid to Gaza's desperate civilians. The Israeli Prime Minister's office said late on Tuesday the details of Hamas's response were being, quote, thoroughly evaluated by the officials involved in the negotiations.
That's Diane Toe of Reuters reporting for us today.
צה"ל מחולל נפלאות ומתקדם בשיטתיות להשיג את כל מטרות המלחמה שאנחנו בדרך.
Speaking at a press conference early Wednesday evening in Israel that began just as production on this show was finishing, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that the hostages and their families are always on his mind. However, an Israeli total victory is required for security and that the future control of Gaza must not go to those who teach terror. For more on this developing story, visit our website, voanews.com. For more context on the deal and a look into public opinion, I'm joined by VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Well, there's basically a three-stage deal in which in the first stage, there would be female hostages, men under 19, the elderly and the sick would be released during the first 45-day phase in exchange for Palestinian women and children in Israeli jails, a lot more humanitarian aid coming in, and Israel getting out of the populated areas in Gaza. In the second stage, the remaining male hostages, including soldiers, would be released in exchange for probably about 1,500 Palestinians, among them hundreds of Palestinians who have been convicted of murdering Israelis. And in the third stage, it would be an exchange of bodies and basically the end of the war. And that's where the problem is for Israel, where Israel has refused to say that it would mean the end of the war, even though, you know, if you have a more than 4 months pause in the war, it seems unlikely that Israel would then go back to fighting. But yet Hamas is making this a condition that Israel will agree that it means the war is completely over. And Israel has said that's something it's not willing to accept.
Well, that's the Israeli authorities' position. What's the opinion of the Israeli public like? I know the families of the hostages are very vocal and very powerful politically. Is there a feeling from them they want everyone released all at once instead of in stages like the proposal is?
Well, obviously they would prefer that, but I think that they want anything that will bring their relatives home. And there's a sense, a growing sense, that time is running out for the hostages. However, it's not clear even how many of them are still alive. The Israeli army has said already that 32 of the 136 are dead. And there have been press reports both yesterday in the New York Times and other places that an additional 20 may also be dead. And there's a lot isn't known about the fate of some of the others. So I think that for live hostages, the Israeli public, most of the public would support almost any deal.
And what do we know about public opinion in Gaza and in the West Bank?
Look, it's much harder to get public opinion, a sense in the West Bank and Gaza, especially in Gaza, because, you know, Hamas is certainly not a democracy. And if you post on Facebook, you know, I think Hamas has destroyed Gaza, you will quickly get a visit from Hamas security people. So people are kind of afraid to say anything. There is some sense that the public, at least in small numbers, is turning against Hamas. There have been demonstrations saying, you know, our situation is so much worse now, and we blame both Israel and Hamas for the terrible humanitarian crisis in Gaza. In the West Bank, again, what you see is support for Hamas, actually more than in Gaza. And Hamas is seen as having successfully resisted against, you know, Israel. You also see public opinion support for the two-state solution, meaning an independent Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza alongside Israel. You see that falling among both the Palestinian public and the Israeli public. So the situation is actually pretty grim. And I think that there's, you know, it's 4 months. People are just tired of the war, the economic consequences, the personal consequences. You still have tens of thousands of Israeli soldiers doing reserve duty. At the same time, they want those hostages home.
Linda, Secretary Blinken is in the region. He's presented Hamas's opinions, Hamas's answers on this proposed deal to the Israeli authorities. What happens next? When do we know? How will we know if this deal is going to happen?
So first of all, I think it's going to take a while. This isn't anything immediate. The Egyptians are saying that indirect talks will begin on Sunday, basically between Israel and Hamas, that are going to be mediated either by the Egyptians and by Qatar and the United States. But the sense that I get is that we're still weeks away from a deal. Maybe I hope not, both for, you know, especially for the hostages, but also the list. Apparently Hamas is insisting that there be a 1,500 Palestinian prisoners released and many of them have been murdered. You know, many of them have been convicted of murder. I think that's going to be a tough one, both for the Israeli public and the Israeli government to accept.
VOA's Linda Gradstein is in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your analysis. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you, Steve.
Will internal politics pose a threat to the Ukrainian military? Plus, Kyiv was the target of deadly Russian missile attacks early Wednesday morning. Anna Chernikova has the latest.
At least two residential buildings were damaged quite badly in the city of Kyiv. At least 60 families were evacuated from the building. At this point, we have confirmation from the local authorities that four people were confirmed killed and 40 people injured.
And how close was this to where you are?
Well, one of the neighborhoods is my neighborhood, actually, and I've heard the explosion quite well. Actually, I've heard personally a couple of explosions, up to five explosions, and one of the explosions was a ballistic missile, and the sound was very different from others. At least this particular ballistic missile was quite close, and probably this was the one in my neighborhood because, our residential building was also shaking a little bit.
Must have been a terrifying night. I'm so sorry.
Well, yeah, it was a tough night, and especially the timing of the attack was the air raid alarm started around 6 o'clock in the morning or so, and then it was on, and the shelling was ongoing for a couple of hours.
Now, shelling aside, President Zelensky has some other challenges on his hands these days. There's a bit of an internal political dispute with Valery Zaluzhny, the head of the armed forces. Can you tell us a bit about what's going on there and help set up this next story for us?
Ukraine is currently in a very tough situation inside the country internally because people are getting really worried as certain internal divisions are getting public and difficult to hide, really. President Zelensky announced, and he actually told this to some international media sources, as well as there is information that he already told this to the U.S. officials, that he is thinking of firing and replacing his top and most popular within the Ukrainians general Valery Zaluzhny, who is currently the head of the armed forces, and this perceived by the society extremely negatively because Zaluzhny has over 70% support, and this is the most support any leader, either military or political leader in Ukraine, has at this point. And everyone is getting, everyone's here inside the country. I mean, the society is getting scared that such shakes inside the country can influence negatively Ukraine's ability to fight Russian aggression.
And here's Anna's story on Valery Zaluzhny and President Zelensky's rift.
Victoria Nuland, Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs of the United States, made another visit to Kyiv this month amid reports of an internal brewing rivalry in Ukraine. Nuland said her visit aimed to reassure Ukraine of Washington's continued support.
As hard as these days are, I will tell you that Ukraine is stronger and more resilient this winter than when I visited here last winter. We continue to provide security support in all categories, including new investments and new weapon systems.
Nuland's visit came at a tense moment inside the country, as a split between President Zelensky and his popular commander-in-chief of the armed forces, Valery Zaluzhny, became public and difficult to hide. Zelensky has informed U.S. officials he intends to replace Zaluzhny. Ukrainian analysts believe that the threat of internal destabilization is high, and Nuland's visit may indicate the allies are worried about it too. Vitaly Kulik is director of the Center for the Study of Civil Society Issues. We can already say that Zaluzhny's removal from the post of commander-in-chief is inevitable, he says. He adds that the removal of Zaluzhny, the disgrace and everything connected with it now, means that this is a political crisis. Kulik says the crisis means Ukrainian political and military leadership will face challenges in meeting Ukraine's international commitments. He says the West requires, first of all, certainty. Remove uncertainty, remove strategic confusion, provide certainty, and present a definite strategy. Ukraine's brewing political crisis comes at a crucial time, as the country begins a third year of war against the full-scale Russian invasion, the battle is being increasingly defined by fatigue among both Ukraine's international supporters, who are talking about cutting aid, and here at home, as anxiety grows over a victory that is not coming fast enough. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. There's chaos on the streets of Dakar following an announcement that elections will be delayed. That story coming up in a moment. There's also chaos in Pakistan. Elections are set for Thursday, but two explosions at candidates' office in the Baluchistan province have killed at least 30 people and injured dozens. In Islamabad, authorities are preparing. Akbar Nasir Khan is police chief.
There will be 6,500 police officers who will be deployed for these duties on the election day. And that has started with the transportation of the electoral material from today. In addition to this, there will be frontier constabulary officers. There will be officers from the Azad Jammu and Kashmir police and also from Pakistan Rangers and Pakistan Armed Forces, who are providing a very essential part of the security for these general elections of 2024.
This all follows the conviction and jailing of former Prime Minister and opposition leader Imran Khan last week. Any large-scale gathering of Khan supporters near polling places could raise tensions because of what they're calling a military-backed crackdown on him and his party that has restricted campaigning. The military denies interfering in politics. Meanwhile, when Senegal's president Macky Sall announced that a February 25th election would be delayed, the West African country veered into uncharted constitutional territory. Reuters' David Doyle examines what happens now and why it's important.
Senegal's parliament has voted to postpone a presidential election from February 25th to December 15th, extending President Macky Sall's mandate. That's triggered widespread public outcry and potentially tarnishes Senegal's image as one of West Africa's more stable democracies. Why, therefore, did Sall announce a delay?
Mon engagement solennel.
He said it was because of a dispute over the election's candidate list and alleged corruption within the constitutional body that compiled it. In a surprise speech to the nation hours before official campaigning was due to begin, he said these, quote, troubled conditions could seriously undermine the credibility of the ballot by sowing the seeds of pre- and post-electoral disputes. But Senegal's recent history has already seen disputes, at times carried out violently in the streets. They've been triggered by concerns that Sall, who has reached the constitutional limit of two terms in office, would run again. Demonstrations have also taken place over the alleged political sidelining of opposition leader Ousmane Sonko. Sall has said, both before and after the announcement of a postponement, that he is not running for a third term. However, some opposition and civil society groups accuse Sall of orchestrating an institutional coup to extend his tenure. A number of presidential candidates have submitted legal challenges, raising the prospect of a protracted court battle. And there have been protests in the streets, prompting police to fire tear gas and make arrests. However, there is some opposition support. Indeed, it was the Senegalese Democratic Party, whose candidate was excluded from the final candidate list over dual nationality issues, that proposed the postponement bill in Parliament before Sall's address. But the president's announcement still took people by surprise. That includes Senegalese citizens like Pape Sene.
If Macky Sall had said from the beginning that it might be possible to consider postponing the elections, people could have anticipated it. But to decide like this overnight, it can only lead to confusion.
But it's also potentially caught the international community off guard. Senegal has never delayed a presidential vote and held four largely peaceful transfers of power since independence from France in 1960. The abrupt postponement has dismayed those who believed the West African country would stick to a standard electoral course. That's in a region that's become a proxy battleground between Western powers and Russia, following several military coups in recent years. The African Union, the United States, and regional bloc ECOWAS have all raised concerns. An analysis by Barclays warned that a postponement could open the door for subsequent postponements and allow the president to do many things.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. And finally today, India has deployed at least 10 warships in the Arabian Sea to provide security east of the Red Sea, where drone attacks by Houthi rebels and a resurgence in piracy are posing a security challenge. As Anjana Pasricha reports, India's large naval deployment is seen as part of the country's ambition to be seen as a rising power.
From helping douse a fire on a Marshall Islands flagged tanker that was struck by a missile fired by Houthi rebels, to rescuing vessels hijacked by pirates, Indian Navy warships have been providing security to merchant ships in the Arabian Sea. India has not joined the US-led task force for the Red Sea that is launching strikes against Iran-backed Houthi rebels whose missile and drone attacks on commercial ships have disrupted global trade. But since December, India has deployed about 10 warships that include guided missile cruisers as well as surveillance aircraft to police waters east of the Red Sea. Harsh Pant, Vice President Studies and Foreign Policy at the Observer Research Foundation in New Delhi, explains the significance of India's maritime boost in the Arabian Sea.
I think the scale is quite unprecedented, and I think in some ways this represents a confidence that Indian Navy has in its own abilities. And I think the requirement to be seen as a benevolent regional player that is not simply looking after its own interests, but also the interests of the global common.
The Navy has helped at least two ships struck by missiles and drones, according to Indian officials. But amid a resurgence in piracy, much of its focus has been on conducting anti-piracy patrols. Last week, it helped rescue two Iranian-flagged fishing vessels hijacked by pirates and released their crew members taken as hostages. Commissioning a hydrographic survey ship, Indian Defence Minister Rajnath Singh said the naval forces aim to protect both trade and regional security. Minister Singh said our Navy has become so strong that we have become the first responder in terms of security in the Indian Ocean and Indian Pacific region. While border disputes with China and Pakistan in the Himalayas had long kept India's focus on the army, the country has also built up its naval prowess in recent decades, acquiring more advanced ships, submarines and aircraft. D.K. Sharma is a former Indian Navy spokesperson.
We are one of the biggest force here, and we know that the world's trade is moving through these routes, and we normally, you know, go with the freedom of seas, freedom of navigation. That is why this deployment has happened, to scan the area, sanitize the area.
Projecting power in the Indian Ocean, which India calls its backyard, signals the country's aspirations to be counted as a responsible emerging power. Analyst Pant again.
Increasingly, that seems to be the answer that India is providing, that look, we are willing to work with the world towards collective ends. We don't, we are not a disruptor to the global order, regional order. We want to be a player, a responsible stakeholder. So naturally, if there is a crisis happening around your periphery, India has to step up to the plate and make its own contribution.
Indian officials hope their deployment will prevent the threats to merchant vessels spilling beyond the Red Sea. Anjana Pasricha, VOA News, New Delhi.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.